Well, welcome to Speaking with Authority. Today, I've got a very special guest. I've been wanting to get him for the longest time because I've been such a fan for a long time. So let me do the setup first before we give the intro. Have you ever been part of a technology rollout that was supposed to make everything better and somehow it made everything worse? More meetings, more confusions, more systems, less clarity. Or you've got one group using Teams and they're sold out on Teams, and another group using Slack and there's that war going on. And then another team using Jira, another team using Rike, another team using Google Documents, another team using Microsoft Excel, and nobody is on the same page. Here is the reality. Most companies don't fail at technology. They fail at communication, they fail at alignment, they fail at leadership, and they completely underestimate the people side of change. So today, we're going to talk a little bit about the real problem. We want to talk about why technology transformations fail, even when the tech is great, why leadership, not software, is almost always the real problem, and what it takes to get people aligned and actually moving forward, and what should you know before you spend millions of dollars on a new system. I've been in rooms with executives who are convinced that a system would fix everything, and I've watched those same projects collapse, not because the software failed, because the leadership did. Which brings me to my guest today, Eric Kimberling. Today's guest is one of the most respected independent voices in enterprise technology. Eric is the CEO of Third Stage Consulting, and what sets him apart is a word that almost doesn't exist in the industry. That word is independent. He's not tied to SAP or Oracle or Microsoft or any implementation partner. No quota, no commissions, no bias, just what's actually right for your business. That independence has made him one of the most sought after experts in the world. When a billion-dollar ERP project collapses and ends up in court, when boards need somebody who can separate fact from spin, Eric is the person they call. He's advised organizations across manufacturing, distribution, the public sector, and beyond. He's been featured on CBS News, The Wall Street Journal, and I'm going to butcher this, Digimonica.
Diginomica.
And what I respect most about what Eric thinks is it's independence over bias and facts over hype and business outcomes over feature lists, because at the end of the day, it isn't about the software. It's about whether the business actually improves. So, Eric, welcome to Speaking with Authority, my friend.
Hi, Jim. Thanks for having me. I'm excited for the conversation.
So for my audience, I've got a varied audience, and in plain language, if you could just start and explain what is an ERP system and why do businesses need an ERP system?
Yeah, so ERP systems, but ERP, first of all, the acronym stands for Enterprise Resource Planning, and that okay. is somewhat of a summary of what ERP systems are, which is the entire enterprise planning resources, pulling everything together into one system, one platform, one single source of truth, one tool set in one set of processes. So ERP systems came to be, you know, in the late 70s, 80s, 90s, when companies were still using, to your point, a lot of spreadsheets, a lot of disparate systems. Sometimes they were using mainframes. Sometimes they were using custom developed code, that sort of thing. And organizations grew, they advanced technologically, but then they found that they had this sort of spaghetti diagram of all these different systems that didn't talk to one another. So along comes a solution, an ERP system would tie that all together, be one platform that integrates everything, gives you one tool set, one system to manage. You don't have to go search for information across systems. And I'm speaking, of course, of that utopia possibility that rarely actually materializes as easily as I have explained it, but that was the intent of ERP systems. So I think of ERP systems as one system to run your entire business end to end.
Oh, I like that. It's a great explanation. Now, how does a CRM or a CRM fit in? And are we talking about the same category of problem or is it something different?
It's a little bit of both. I mean, CRM, first of all, ERP systems have CRM modules. So they'll have a part of the ERP system that can do CRM, but then there's also standalone CRM systems that's all they do is CRM. And mm-hmm. companies like Salesforce is probably the best known CRM. You've got Sugar CRM. Microsoft has a good CRM system. A lot of different solutions that are specific to CRM. And in lies the – I don't know if this is where you want to go with it, but in lies the debate or the dilemma. I go find a CRM system that's really, really good at CRM, goes super deep, but it doesn't necessarily integrate easily or right away with the rest of the operations? Or – do I go find an ERP system that does some CRM, but it does everything else too, but maybe it doesn't do CRM as good as a Salesforce or a CRM dedicated thing? And that's the trade-off that organizations have to make. And quite frankly, it's a lot easier said than done to make that decision because there's risks and rewards and pros and cons to whichever direction you go.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's all individual and how the organization is working and how it's structured. That's why it's best to start with somebody like you to help them think through stuff like that.
Right. Yeah. And that's the thing and that's where it gets confusing because, you know, if I'm talking like, I know this wasn't your question, but if you were asking me what's better for a sales group, would it be better to go implement a CRM system or should the broader organization go implement an ERP system? I can make a really strong argument for either. You know, I could argue both sides of that coin. And that's mm-hmm. and there's really good arguments for both. And I think that's where it's tricky. And that's where you need someone objective that can look at you as a company and your strategy, your goals, your culture, your resources. And that's going to lead you to the path that's best for you, which may or may not be the same path that others follow.
Yeah. And the CRMs, you know, a lot of times the challenge, you know, the people issue that I see is once you start having a management or leadership start getting data, they become focused on data and forget about the process. You know, I had one that was so focused on, well, we need to know this about the customer. We need to know this about the customer. And so all the sales reps is, you know, they're becoming, you know, inputting data and not outselling. And that's a challenge that you have there with a lot of leadership issues. So when a company is thinking about this, when you're helping companies or leadership, a lot of times, even companies that grow really fast, they might not have all these things into place. How do you kind of vet, do they need this system? What do they need? How do they need it? What would you tell them?
There's a lot of nuances to that answer mm-hmm. or to that, the response to that question. I mean, you first of all have to understand, where are you today? How did you get to where you are? What's made you successful? What's your secret sauce? What's your culture as an organization? What kind of company are you? Are you risk adverse? Mm-hmm. Are you risk tolerant? Are you, you know, fast growth, fast moving? Are you third generation family business? You're trying to just hold down the fort and, you know, grow incrementally. You know, and there's no right or wrong answer. It's not meant to be a judgmental question because I think that's where we get this industry gets hung up. Like, you know, if you're risk adverse, then you're a problem, or if you're not willing to, you know, swing for the fences on new technologies, then you're going to fall behind. I always set that stuff aside and say, okay, that's great. That's what the technology industry wants you to think, but let's think for ourselves here. Let's look at our business and who we are, and not only who we are and how we got to where we are, but where are we going? So we know something has happened or shifted where we've outgrown our current systems. Maybe what got us to where we are today isn't going to get us to where we want to go. So what does that look like? What is that roadmap? What's that path? What are the best options for us? And what are the risks and trade-offs that we need to consider as we define that? So it really comes down to, more than anything, who you are, where you're going, and then how do we find a strategy that aligns, a technology or transformation strategy that aligns with our broader business goals and objectives. If we get those two things out of sync, there's almost a 0% likelihood of success. I mean, you just can't succeed in these projects if your technology strategy doesn't align with what you're trying to do as a business. And it's amazing to me how often companies, they have this grand level vision up here, but then down here at the technology strategy level, they go in completely different directions that aren't aligned with that bigger picture strategy.
Yeah, that's good insight. Now, I want to start with you with something I've seen over and over again. So I've been involved in a lot of technology upgrades, some huge, some small, and I've noticed something counterintuitive. Great technology implemented terribly, or average technology somehow actually working. Mm-hmm. In your experience, when a transformation goes wrong, is it usually a technology problem or is it a leadership problem? And how so?
It's leadership and everything else but the technology, typically. I mean, technology is oftentimes the least of your worries in these projects, mm-hmm. but yet it becomes all-consuming, which is the irony of it all. When you're implementing technology, it's almost like a human bias or a human blind spot where I can see and touch and feel the technology, so I'm going to go over here and just focus on building stuff because I can see it.
Yeah.
Over here, when you talk about leadership, I can't really see that. When I talk about culture, when I talk about organizational resistance or readiness, that's just fluff. Yeah, I'm speaking a bit facetiously here, but that's the mindset that organizations often have. And so the human bias is to go focus on the technology, even though that's probably the least important part of it. To your point, the average technology that's implemented really well, I'll bet money on that all day over better technology that isn't implemented as well.
Yeah, it's a great point. Now, can you give me a story without naming names of a project where the technology was really solid, but it still failed, and kind of what actually goes wrong?
Yeah, well, it's hard to pick one example because there's so many of them, but I'm going to pick SAP as an example just because it's a well-known product. It's a very sophisticated, very mature product, S/4HANA. A lot of big companies implement S/4. And a lot of those projects are highly troubled. And it's not because S/4HANA isn't a good product. It is a very good product. The problem is, in some ways, technology has become so advanced and so sophisticated that, first of all, it's too disruptive to the business in the short term. They can't digest that volume of change in a relatively short period. So that's the real challenge is I've got this great, sexy, shiny technology that can do all these things. But for some reason, I can't figure out how to get it to work for my business. And that's the tricky part because I can't get people to understand the technology. I can't get the technology and the processes to quite sync up the way I need them to. I'm a complex organization and the software is going to force me into some standardization and some common processes. It's just painful. Like it's not an easy process to go through. But again, to your point, it's not because SAP is a weak product. So I can give you a lot of examples. I can pick just about any implementation and chances are pretty high that is a problem statement for that company, even our own clients. I mean, I'd love to say our clients don't have that problem, but they do. They all struggle with the same thing.
That's good. I like that. Now, when companies are implementing something, what are companies actually trying to solve when they invest in new technology? And how often are they solving the wrong problem?
Great question. I would say this is a very, very relevant point, especially here in 2026 where we stand. It's always been relevant, but even more so than ever today, I would say, because more than ever, you're seeing companies that are implementing for the wrong reasons or not a complete enough reason, I should say. So I'd say the top two reasons why companies are trying to implement technology now is because, A, their old technology is about to be sunset or maintenance is about to be discontinued. And so they have a product that's on the verge of being obsolete. Mm-hmm. That's an okay reason, but that's not enough. That's probably the number one reason we hear. The number two reason we hear is because I want to be an AI-driven organization. I want to put AI capabilities in place, and I can't do it with my old legacy system. It's on-prem. It's a bunch of spreadsheets, whatever. So those are the two main reasons we hear most commonly, and those are fine reasons. I'm not saying those are bad reasons, but if that's all you've got, you're going to run into problems because it's not a good enough reason. You need to go a step further and say, well, okay, you want to replace your technology because the one you have is obsolete. You want AI. Great. Let's start there. But we got to keep building there. What else do you want? What do you want your business to look like? What do you want to be when you grow up? What kind of value do you expect to get out of this? How much risk are you willing to take? What kind of investment are you willing to make? You know, you really need to drill down into that before you get too far into picking a technology, starting to deploy it, and all that good stuff. And it gets back to what you're alluding to earlier around leadership. That's where strong leadership needs to come in and say, hold on, you know, we will get there. We'll get to a technology implementation. But before we do that, let's make sure we've got a clear vision, a clear strategy, and just clear alignment on what it is we're trying to accomplish as a business beyond just let's put in AI, let's replace the old technology. It's got to be more than that.
Yeah. The most powerful question that came out from that is the technology decision ever really about the technology?
It's a good question. It oftentimes is. Should it be, I guess, is maybe the way I'd frame it, is should it be about the technology? It's easy to get caught up in all the bells and whistles and features and functions and getting into analysis paralysis of, oh, these two systems are both great, but this one doesn't have the screen that I like. Or, you know, you get hung up on a lot of these little nuances that, you know, on one hand, you don't want to be dismissive of those things because it is a way to gain buy-in from the organization. Mm-hmm. If you get people to be on board with, okay, I was part of the decision and I'm part of the solution, that helps from a change management perspective. But at the same time, you don't want to get into analysis paralysis because, first of all, the technology changes so quickly. What you're looking at today and demoing today is probably not going to be what you actually implement because it's going to change and hopefully be better than what you're seeing today. So somewhat of a moving target.
Yeah.
But secondly, to your point, it's okay – you know, if we're talking about, you know, the button, the color of a button on a screen on a purchase order, that's largely irrelevant to business value. Now, of course, again, from a change management perspective, I can't say, Jim, your opinion sucks. It doesn't matter what color the button is. You're not going to say that, but you know, you have to know how to tactfully back up and say, oh, let's back up and look at the bigger picture. Which one fits our strategic goals? Which one is going to deliver more value? Those, I think, are the bigger decision points versus technical functions and features.
Right. That's really good. Let's talk about, you know, how companies choose systems, because I think where a lot of damage is done is before the project even starts. You know, walk me through what a bad decision-making looks like in the selection process. What does the room actually look like?
Yeah. So I would say bad decision process is saying, I'll give you two examples. One would be, I know a guy who's a CIO or whatever. I know a guy, he's a friend of mine, and he uses vendor A and he likes it. So let's go ahead and deploy vendor A based on that. And, you know, it's a data point, but that's not a very good reason to deploy technology, especially when you have as many options out there that are available and so many good options. The second one would be, well, I'm working with a consulting firm and they came in and recommended that product. On one hand, yes, you want outside advice, but you also have to be aware of, are there hidden biases, economic interests in me recommending a product to you? Because if I get commission on a product, I'm probably going to push that product pretty hard. And that's one of the biggest, darkest secrets, or it's not even a secret, but it's the biggest, darkest side of the enterprise tech space is you've got all these consultants out there. They're supposed to be looking out for customer best interest, but in reality, a lot of them make more money from the vendors by recommending their products. So there's a conflict of interest there. And so you just have to know, you know, trust but verify, I guess, when you get to that point.
I'm shocked. There's conflicts of interest in this.
I know. And there's money to be made. A lot of money is to be made. And people act weird when money's at stake. It's funny how that works.
In your observation, is it usually a lack of expertise that drives the poor decisions, or is it internal politics? You know, and which do you think is more dangerous?
Well, that's a good question. I don't know which is more dangerous. It's all pretty dangerous. But I'd say, you know, politics, yeah, maybe. I think internal politics and misalignment is more likely to lead to a non-decision, though, and doing nothing.
Yeah.
But I'd say the outside political influence is more damaging. So, for example, you know, I'm not going to name specific names here, but if I'm working with a big four consulting firm because they're my auditor, or they've done other consulting work for me, and I call them up and say, hey, I trust you guys. Can you come in and give us a recommendation? They're going to have their agenda, right? They're going to push whatever product they are pushing and whatever one they're affiliated with. And that is actually the really dark part. I think the internal stuff, it is a problem, but it's not as likely to lead to bad decisions as that outside, that outside influence.
I like that. Now, if you had to name, you know, what's the one single biggest mistake companies do choosing new technology? Is there one that you could come up with, or is there?
I think it's choosing based on brand name and cachet, you know, because a lot of times there's still the mentality, especially the bigger the organization, the more likely this is to be true. There's still a mindset of no one ever get fired for choosing whatever, SAP, Microsoft, pick a vendor, IBM. I think the original saying was no one ever got fired for choosing IBM or for hiring IBM. But people still apply that, or that same mindset exists when it comes to like SAP and Oracle, some of the bigger names. Those products are fine, but, you know, we're in the 2020s here, and I don't think the enterprise tech landscape is going to look the same in the 2030s at all as it does today. So you can't base it just on that alone, the name and the market share or the cachet of a vendor. Not to mention the fact that even if these same vendors are going to be around long term or going to be as relevant long term, I can name plenty of people that got fired for picking and trying to implement one of those products. Yeah. So it's a false perception that you're safer if you go with a big name. A lot of times there's actually, you could argue there's more risk in those cases because it's a bigger product, it's more complex, and there's a lot of smaller, lighter, more flexible products out there that maybe it could be a good fit for you. It could be that the big ones are a fine fit. I'm not saying don't go that direction, but make sure you're looking at all your options and looking at, you know, the trade-offs.
Yeah. That's good. Now, here's a debate that I see playing out a lot. You know, should users be involved in selecting the system, or does that turn into 40 people with opinions that nothing gets decided? Where do you land on that?
Oh, man. I actually struggle with that a lot because, first of all, I'll back up and say it depends on what you're trying to do. You know, if you want to make a relatively quick decision, then you don't want to involve 40 or 50 people. If you want to slow things down, know it's going to take you a little longer, but you want to create more buy-in, engagement, and excitement for the project, then slow it down, involve more people, know that it's going to get messy and you're going to get probably too many opinions, more than you want, but you're doing it in the name of not necessarily just getting to a decision, but also getting people involved and getting them, getting their support. Because you're going to need those same people later on when things get rough and you're facing adversity and resistance to change and, you know, misalignment between process and technology. You're going to need those people to be on board. And if they were part of the decision, they're a lot less likely to say, well, Jim, you're the one that recommended it. I didn't want this system. You did. So good luck figuring that out. Let me know when you figured it out. Whereas, I was part of that. I better help Jim figure that out because Jim and I both decided that this is what was best for us. So it depends on what you're trying to do, but I think you just have to recognize you're not going to have an easy answer either way. You're going to get a faster decision, but then you're going to have to work harder on change management later, or you start to build that change management up front, but it might take you a little longer to get to a decision.
Yeah, I think you need to get buy-in too from the stakeholders. So, you know, I was involved with a implementation with a company that grew really fast. They had hundreds and hundreds of salespeople, and they were going to move into Salesforce. And one of the challenges was, it's like, oh, well, this is a no-brainer. CRO comes in. We're just doing it. Here you go. And then it's who moved my cheese. Everyone's like, well, wait a minute. My system worked great and everything else. There was no buy-in. There was no selling. There was no, this is how it's going to work. This is the vision. You know, I think there needs to be a step back, say, we're going to do this, but not just say, here, log in. We need you to do all this other stuff. And, we'll do the training down the road. If you get the buy-in earlier on, you have a smoother implementation, and there's ways of doing it, you know, but I'm always focused on the head game of it, the people game, the leadership game, the strategy. You know, I understand the technology side, and there's good team members that are going to work on that, but the psychology of change is the thing that I'm always focusing on.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a big part of what I've been fascinated by in recent years is just all the organizational psychology, human behavior, human biases. I mean, I think all that stuff, what you're alluding to, that is the real root cause of the challenges in this industry. It's easy to blame the vendors or the system integrators or individuals, but it's really a systemic psychological thing that, you know, you just have to recognize it's the reality. And we could complain about it, or we could just understand it and know that that's just something we have got to navigate. Be aware of.
Yeah. And you've got two sides of the spectrum. You've got one guy that's like, let's do it. Let's get it going. Let's, and they're just, you know, going after Moby Dick in the rowboat, bring the tartar sauce. I'm ready to go. And the other guy's talking about, should we have a blue button or a green button, you know, to where they get so far into the weeds. And you've got to get those people to work together to say, okay, what's important, what's not important, because you want the detail guy or the gal who can see those details that the other person's blind to. But if you get so fixated on all of these details and features and all this other stuff, then the ship's not going to move. You know, you've got to get it out of the harbor and move it for the sails to work, for the rudder to work, to have all that. So it's a challenge, you know, when you're thinking about that.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's a balancing act for sure.
Now, one of the things I see consistently, and I'd love your read on this, is companies invest in technology to create alignment, but instead they end up with 5 tools, 3 worksheets, and 4 departments who refuse to talk to each other. Why does more technology so often produce worse communication and fragmentation and not less?
It's a good question. And I would say the leading reason, in my opinion, is because there wasn't a clearly defined overarching strategy from the start. So, you know, if I'm a finance person and I want to go, you know, find a consolidation tool, a tool that allows me to do consolidation and integrated reporting, I might say, you know what, we've got all these disparate systems. I need a system that can make sense of all those technologies. Rather than saying, why don't we consolidate those systems into one, I might go find a Band-Aid. You know, I might be more likely to go out and just find the Band-Aid that helps pull together those. Mm-hmm. And that's what happens when you are too decentralized in your decision-making authority around what your technology strategy and roadmap is going to be. Now, you've got to balance that. Some organizations, you know, they don't want to be total command and control top down, but you might have to move that direction if you're trying to move towards a common platform, or you're trying to, it's not even about platforms. A lot of times through acquisition over the years. We've acquired all these different companies. We didn't fully integrate them. Now we've got this hodgepodge of systems. You're going to need to move at some point to a standardized top down command and control sort of style to move towards that direction. I know it's not cool to talk about, and business schools don't talk about command and control in a very flattering way, or top-down management isn't nearly as cool as, you know, the more servant leadership, flat hierarchy type leadership styles. But there is a time and place for a more centralized view. And I think that's where organizations stumble, is they let these pockets of organizations make their own decisions, and there's no clear overarching strategy. And so you end up with a bunch of different tools that don't talk to one another. And then I end up complaining because you're the problem, Jim. I've got my technology over here. It's doing my job, right? But your technology sucks, or, you know, your process is broken. And so it just creates more chaos, you know, more resistance.
Yeah, I've been with organizations that have over 1,000 employees, and, you know, you've got the management and sales department, they're using Teams. They love Teams. That's how they work. And then you go to the tech department and they're Slack, and they're dug in, you know? So when different departments want different tools and they're dug in, who do you think should make the final call, and how should they make it?
Well, that's a great question. 'Cause, you know, you look at some of these big bucket decisions that have to be made beyond just, you know, it goes beyond just which technology am I going to deploy. It gets into, let's just say you get business and IT to both agree on the system or systems you're going to deploy. Well, then you've got a bunch of other decisions you've got to make, such as, are we going to customize the software at all? Or are we going to just use the software off the shelf out of the box? Now, the technologist in me would say, use it off the shelf. Don't customize it, because that's just more complicated from a tech perspective. It's more maintenance, it's more work, but it could be that that's actually better for the business. And so then the question is, well, who's more important? Is it better for IT to get what they want, or is the business value in the business? And I would argue, I tend to lean towards and err on the side of, let's focus on what the business needs are, knowing that at least if there's a technical risk we've introduced, or a technical complexity or cost, at least it's somewhat isolated to the technology team. It's not, you know, it's not spread to the entire business. So if I'm mitigating material risk over here in the business, and it means I've got to shift additional cost or complexity or things I don't like to IT, that's what I would do as a leader. Now, having said that, a lot of our clients are CIOs, and they manage the IT group, and the loudest voice in the room is oftentimes their IT team. And that's where things get tricky, because then the IT team ends up having more authority or power over those decisions. And then the business ends up stuck holding the bag, trying to figure out how we're going to make this work for our operations. And so I think, though, if I were to take it a step further, I would say it shouldn't be a CIO or an IT or a business decision. It should be a leadership decision that depersonalizes and says, this isn't about who's, you know, Jim's feelings, because he's going to have to maintain, you know, a system that's more complicated now. It's not about that. It's not about Jim. It's about what makes sense as a business. And then once you make that decision, then you've got to figure out, okay, this is going to adversely affect some people, or some people aren't going to like this. And that's going to be the decision. That's going to be the outcome either way, by the way. Someone's not going to be happy. Yeah. So just get over that, because that's just going to happen. Yeah. It's just a matter of who, and then how are you going to mitigate it?
Yeah, always. Now, is there a pattern you see in companies that do achieve alignment, something that they do differently in the early stages?
They stop. They not stop, which is the word I'm looking for. They slow down. They stop thinking about technology so much and start thinking more about who are we trying to be as a business. Yeah. And the ones that can define and clearly articulate who they're trying to be and who they want to be in the next 3 to 5 years, Those are the companies that are more likely to succeed, because then they've got this lens. They've got a clear lens to see through to make these decisions. If you don't have that lens, it's just all a bunch of noise and I'm looking for the perfect answer and I can't find it. It's like a needle in a haystack. I'm not going to find it, but I'm going to keep searching and I'm going to keep spinning my wheels in the unending search for the perfect answer. But if you've got that lens of clarity around strategy, I'm not saying it makes it easy, but at least you know what tough decisions you have to make and it becomes more clear.
I think that's spot on. Now I want to talk about a little bit about buy-in or bust. And it's kind of a little bit of a shift where I think it's the most underestimated piece of this. It's the people. Okay. And I've watched great systems fail, not because the software was bad, but because the team never bought in. They don't use it. They don't work. They'll work around it. And if people aren't using it, it fails. Full stop. You know, how important is it from your perspective for the people who actually use the system to have buy-in or on a scale to higher than it would be nice to have to the whole thing lives and dies based upon that buy-in? So help me flesh that out a little bit.
Yeah, it's funny you say this because I've been experimenting lately with more edutainment type content, you know, stuff that's not purely educational but also entertaining. And I created a hypothetical, but it's not so hypothetical, character called Spreadsheet Guy. And he's the guy in every organization that has the ultimate spreadsheet that can do everything. And you will never find an off-the-shelf system that can do what this spreadsheet can do. So he's meant to be kind of a nuisance to the organization. He's the nuisance to the project team. He's a nuisance to the change management team because they're trying to get buy-in. They're trying to get people on board with the new changes. And then you've got Spreadsheet Guy over here saying, no, that system sucks. I've got a spreadsheet that can do it better. And the reason I created that moniker, that character, is because it's true. It happens all the time. I mean, I feel like every client, I can name the people that fit Spreadsheet Guy. And so I think that's one thing you have to be aware of is that buy-in from the ivory tower in the boardroom looks a lot different than the buy-in out on the front lines. And so you've got to get in the trenches and get people that are in the trenches to be part of that. And that's where that change agent network becomes so important. The super users, the champions of change, you know, you need those people that are close to the front lines that can mitigate the mess that Spreadsheet Guy causes in the organization. It's not just Spreadsheet Guy. Obviously it's other people that, you know, just the system isn't perfect. It's not as good as my old one, or I'm more comfortable with the old system. So I'm just going to revert back to that because it's easier. It's a path of least resistance. So it's a good question. There's a lot to it. And that's why having such a robust change strategy and plan is so important, because you've got to really attack that, because that, you know, we spend so much time attacking the technical issues back to the earlier point, but we don't spend nearly enough time attacking the people issues. And when I say attack, that's probably not the right word, but you know, tackling is maybe a better word.
Yeah. Wrestling with.
Yes. Wrestling with. There you go.
I love the idea of the spreadsheet guy. That is so good, because what it does is it gives a persona and it also gives contrast. And so in storytelling, that's really, really important. And a good friend of mine, brilliant guy, Jeremy Kubitschek, written several books on leadership, probably the best leadership guru out there. He came up with an idea of Richard Tater as far as the leader. And he had me play that role. He goes by Dick, you know, and my way, the highway. My voice is the only one that matters. Shut up and take orders, and, you know, dogmatic, demonstrative. And we just had a blast with this, creating this character. And that's why I love the spreadsheet guy, because it's just spot on to that, because you can really have fun with it. And in a way, you're communicating to people in a fun way that they instantly get it. And so that is brilliant. I love that, Eric.
You'll have to check it out on TikTok or YouTube Shorts. That's where you find it. There's a short little fun videos.
I'm definitely going to go find it. Now, do companies treat implementation as a technology rollout when they should be treating it more as a behavior change initiative? What's the difference in practice?
They do, and they always have, but I'd say that challenge has become even more pronounced now, because now there's so much with the technology to get your head around. You know, you've got cloud, mm-hmm. you've got analytics, AI, robotics, Industry 4.0. You've got all these like emerging trends, and I view technology as sort of like a hockey stick of innovation. And we're on this upward swing right now where it's a wild ride, right? And so it's hard to keep up. And so that, again, back to the human bias, the human blind spots, we tend to gravitate towards that because I can see the technology changing. I know I've got to get AI in here. I've got to get analytics. I got to move all this stuff to the cloud. Yeah. And it's the exact opposite of what you just said, which where we should be focused is on cultural change, behavioral change, leadership. And if we go back to the fundamentals, if we forget technology, that's why I said earlier when you're asking what do the successful organizations do when they're aligned, well, one thing they do is they say, forget technology. We're not talking about AI. We're not talking about ERP or CRM. We're talking about us as a business. What's our future state going to look like? What's the operating model? What kind of goals and objectives are we trying to accomplish? And then now let's fit technology into that rather than saying, here's the technology. Now let's figure out how we're going to get it to work. Those are two different mindsets, and one works really well and the other one doesn't work so well.
Eric, that's really good. If leadership is committed, but the front line isn't, is the project already failing or is there a point of no return? I guess the mic drop question would be, can you rescue buy-in once you've lost it? Or is a project you're managing going towards failure?
You can get it back. It's harder to get it back once you've lost it, but I'd rather have that with committed leadership than having the buy-in of the organization and your leadership's a little, you know, checked out or maybe not all on the same page, because eventually that buy-in will wane and the buy-in is not sustainable if the leaders aren't on board. So I know you didn't ask it in a binary either or sort of way, but, you know, I would say I would err more towards just make I'm much happier with a client when they've got leadership buy-in and alignment and clarity, because you'll get the buy-in eventually. It may be painful. You may have lost it. You may have had some hiccups along the way that cause people to lose faith. But as long as the leadership team is aligned, you'll get it back. But if you don't have that, you just have no chance. So that's maybe the better way to look at it is look at it from the top down. Start at the top. If you've got that and if you've lost the buy-in down here, that's not ideal. You try to avoid it if you can. But if you have lost it already, you know, there are ways you can get it back. And usually it involves using your leaders, your change agents, and some of the others that are credible within the organization.
Yeah, that's good. I think let's kind of change gears here. I want to talk a little bit about the psychology of pushback. So inside of every transformation, you've got different types of people, people who resist, people who are burned out from the last change initiative, and people who are ready, but waiting for everyone else to catch up. Why do people resist change, even when the current system is clearly broken and everyone knows it? What's happening, you think, psychologically?
Well, it's a few things. One is on the surface, most organizations, most teams are on board with change. If you ask any of our clients when we're first starting a project, you know, you ask the employees, the frontline people, are you on board with change? Most of the time you get an overwhelming resounding yes, we are absolutely ready for change. Our systems suck. There's so much opportunities for improvement. I want my job to be easier, et cetera, et cetera. So on the surface, you know, executives oftentimes say, okay, Eric, I know change management. You know, you in third stage have been saying change management is going to be important. I could see why it would be for other companies, but we don't have that problem because everyone's excited about the change. And that's a super easy trap to fall into. It happens all the time because it's misleading, because you're just looking at the tip of the iceberg analogy. You know, at the tip of the iceberg, yep, people are on board, but your question is what's below the iceberg? And what's below the iceberg is painful change that is uncomfortable. And it doesn't matter if it's better or for worse. It's change, right? You're doing things that are disrupting my job. And not only are you disrupting my job, you're doing things that are actually threatening my job. It's not just a tool. It's like you're talking about AI automating, you know, 60% of my work. Well, what the hell am I going to do with the others, you know, with the 60% you're automating? So now all of a sudden the conversation shifts from this is best for the business, I get why it's important, to whoa, hold on. This is going to hurt me. And so you know, the perception, of course, not reality, but perception is it's going to hurt me. So, or there's something I don't know because you haven't told me what I'm going to do with all this time I'm going to save. Yeah, I saw it in a business case. I saw millions of dollars are going to be saved by automating my job. So does that mean I'm losing my job? What, or I'm going to do something else? What am I going to do? So a lot of companies can't answer that question. And when you can't answer that question, people like me are going to say, well, then I'm out. I'm not going to be part of this. Or or I'm going to say I'm on board, or I'm okay with Jim and other people changing. I just don't want to, but everyone else can go ahead and change. That's the dynamic you have to look at is it's fear, uncertainty, and doubt for the most part that causes people to resist change. It's rarely – I mean, it's so rare that you get someone who's just – they're just trying to sabotage the project. They just really don't like change in general, and they aren't on the same page. I mean, that people think that's what change resistance looks like. It's not. It's way more subtle, and it's usually coming from a good place, and it's coming from people that want to help, but they feel threatened. And I can't help – it's like Maslow's hierarchy of needs. I can't help you if I can't help myself. If I feel threatened, then I'm not going to have a job. Suddenly, I move down Maslow's hierarchy. I'm not thinking about – self-actualization of making this company better. I'm thinking about survival. How am I going to pay my bills? And so that's where you have to move people back up Maslow's hierarchy. And the only way you can do that is by giving them clarity, giving them, you know, may not always be what they want to hear, but clarity is so much better than the uncertainty of these projects.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. There's a fear that people have to deal with. Now, a lot of times leaders don't, I guess the question would be, when should a leader stop fighting resistance and start listening to it in some of those key areas? Because a lot of times leaders will not listen, and there are, you know, key insights that they should be hearing before they implement. Is there some one factor or kind of a commonality in that you think about?
Well, I'd say you should always be listening, even if at the end of the day it's ill-informed opinion or irrelevant or less relevant. You always have to be listening because it gets back to that buy-in. If you feel like I'm not listening to you because I already have the answer, no matter what I say, I'm not going to say any words that will make you feel better about the fact that I'm not listening to you. You know what I mean? Yeah. So you do have to listen. I think it's what you do with that, you know, and it's easy as leaders, especially when you get late in the project, timelines are slipping, we're over budget, and then Jim comes along and has some idea that's going to completely derail this project. My instincts might be, no, Jim, too late. Scope's already set. We've already set the timeline. I at least need to listen. Like, tell me, Jim, why is that? Are there other alternatives? Is what you're suggesting, are there other options that might make more sense or that could help within our timeline? You know, and those sort of negotiated conversations are really powerful because usually they lead to you and I getting on the same page without me just telling you no. So I still listen to you. I negotiated with you. I brainstormed some ideas with you, and I may not land exactly where you want, but at least I listened to you. I took some of it into account, came up with a different alternate, but you were heard, and hopefully, you know, maybe it's something we get to in phase two. You know, that's another thing. It's like, well, this phase is focused on this and that, but let's put that on the list for possibilities for phase two, because this project won't be done at go live. We're going to keep expanding and improving over time.
Yeah. Have you ever been in a situation, you know, just kind of on a personal level, you know, we're both doing consulting and you come in, you're the third consultant and there's a whole conference room sitting there, you know, arms folded. It's like, okay, what's this guy? I mean, there's resistance coming in, you know, the company's trying to solve a problem. They're trying to fix it, but you're the third guy in, and you've got to create buy-in for everyone. Is there any magic that you have for consultants out there that go in and are the third or fourth consultant that's trying to fix a problem that hasn't been fixed?
Well, I think back to your question about listening and understanding. If all I do as a consultant is I really, really understand you and your job and your company, Now that gives me a lot of leeway and credibility to be able to start telling you what I think you could do better. If I come in with the answer, which is what unfortunately too many consultants do, and I try to convince you from the start, I'm trying to convince Jim why this is a good idea. I mean, I've already lost you at that point. It doesn't matter. The idea could be the most brilliant thing ever. I've lost you because I haven't listened to you. I don't understand where you're coming from. And I have no credibility. So I think the best way to build credibility isn't about what you know and how smart you are. It's about how well you listen to the client and to the individuals within the client.
Oh, that's good insight. Let's get into some of the things, you know, what you actually do. I want to think about that as far as It's probably the most valuable part of the conversation. Thinking about what does Eric actually do? If a company is about to start a major transformation, what is the first thing they should do before they look at a single piece of software?
Well, the first thing I would do if I were to boil it down to one word is ask why. Mm-hmm. Like, why are we here? Why are we talking about this? And really unpack that. And, you know, on the surface, you start to get the things we talked about earlier. It's, you know, our old systems are outdated. We use too many spreadsheets. We're going to lose support. We want AI. We want whatever. And that's great. You start there and then you keep going, but why? Why do you need AI? Why is it bad that your old system is becoming obsolete? And a lot of times that's where the dead end happens. You get blank looks like, what do you mean? I mean, we just have no choice. We have to replace our system.
Yeah.
And I'll say, why? Why? I mean, what if you didn't? Like, mm-hmm. let's at least talk about it, right? Maybe it's not a viable option, but why is that? Like, if you don't have support, you could hire someone. You could go on for a few more years without support. It's not the end of the world. It's painful. Mm-hmm. It's risky, yes. But in some cases, that might be less painful and risky than a big transformation. So are there other things you could do? So it's just stuff like that, like asking the why, what if, you know, and really exploring these different strategic directions. And then ultimately you settle in on one, you know, okay, mm-hmm. this seems like this is where we need to go. And then you can start to ask the more why, you know, directed down that path. But that's the first thing. If I just did one thing and left the audience with one thing to start with, is just ask why. Just constantly challenge, not in a combative way, not in a change resistance sort of way, but just let's make sure we think this through and have a clear vision for what we're trying to get at here.
Mm, that's good. Now, you've probably walked in a lot of organizations like I have that are in trouble. Mm-hmm. Let me ask you this. How quickly can you determine whether a project is going to succeed or fail? And what are the signals you're looking for in that first hour?
Yeah, good. That's a really good question. So I would say, first of all, I'm looking for leadership alignment. If I sense that we've got seven leaders in the room and they all have seven different opinions that, you know, not that they all have to be homogeneous and groupthink without challenging each other, but they do need to be generally preaching to the same choir, singing from the same hymn book, rowing in the same direction, whatever cliche you want to use. So if you see that they don't have that, that's where I know there's a problem. Because no matter what else we do, we could attack it with change management. We could put better technology in place. We could do an extensive process reengineering exercise. None of that stuff's going to stick if they're not on the same page. So that's the first thing. The second thing I'd look for is, are they approaching this as a technology upgrade? Or are they viewing this and treating it as a business transformation initiative? If they're viewing it as a technology initiative, there's an extremely high risk of failure, unless it really is just, you know, we're moving from incremental upgrade from 6.1 to 6.2. Okay, maybe that's a bit more technical as far as just we're doing some minor upgrades. But even then, you know, you've got to be looking at the impact of the organization, how the processes are going to change, how people are going to get notified and trained on it.
Yeah.
But that might be the one exception. Generally speaking, though, if we're going through a big replacement of technology, if they're viewing it as a big replacement of technology and that's it, then that's a big red flag for sure.
Yeah, that's a good insight. Now, the fun question that I've been dying to ask, I think this is really interesting. You know, you've been an expert witness in some of the biggest ERP lawsuits in the world. Without giving anything away, do you see a common thread? Is what do companies who end up in court with have in common?
Well, I'd say, you know, if I look at the biggest disasters, you know, the biggest catastrophic train wrecks that I've seen, mm-hmm. some of the most common themes are, first of all, I don't even want to say misalignment because it doesn't do it justice, or it's not the right word. It's not powerful enough. It's more political infighting, I guess I'll put it. You know, it's I've got a bunch of people at the top that are just at each other's throats. I mean, forget alignment. They're not aligned. They don't like each other. They can't be in the same room together. They don't communicate. I mean, you look at things like that. I mean, that backdrop is impossible. And when I say impossible, I mean, it's literally impossible. You are not going to succeed in any sort of transformation effort when you've got that sort of leadership dynamic. And so when you've got fundamentally flawed or broken leadership at the top, that's a common theme. The other one is a bit more nuanced and subtle, and that is, you know, the mismanaged expectations. So leadership team might have been aligned, but then they came, you know, someone came in and convinced them that this could be a quick hit 18-month, $10 million implementation when it was never going to be that. It was always going to be 4 years and $50 million or whatever the numbers are.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so you know, someone staked their career and their job on faulty expectations or faulty assumptions, and they weren't able to overcome that. And once you have those unrealistic expectations, that's where you start cutting corners and making really bad decisions, and it becomes sort of death by a thousand paper cuts. So those are a couple of things that come to mind.
Yeah, I like that expectations thing. There's a couple challenges when I've worked on the people side of this. You know, you've got, you know, this is our time frame and the expectation, and this is our budget. Okay, and then by the time you get involved, you know, the time frame has gone here, the budget has gone here, and part of it is misset expectations, and part of it is you don't have the team executing right or communication. There's lots of factors that go into that. Is there, you know, are there warning signs? The warning signs are always there. When this happens, you know, getting into the why these warning signs are ignored is one of the things that I want to try and think about. Why do people ignore these warning signs?
Good question. And it's actually something that I unpacked in my forthcoming book, and it's called Welcome to the Machine. And it's about the inner working of customers, vendors, and system integrators. The machine was built to convince customers that they need technology and that everything's okay. And so early in my career, I used to try to figure out in a more binary way, like, whose fault is it? Is it the vendor's fault? Is it the customer's fault? Is it the system integrator's? And what I came to realize through my career is it's no one person's fault. This system, this industry was built around selling software, which is understandable. And that machine has become so powerful that customers oftentimes just get sucked into it. And so what ends up happening is you get a vendor who's telling you what you want to hear. You've got a system integrator telling you what you want to hear. You've got industry analysts who are perceived to be third party or independent, but they're getting paid by the vendors to publish collateral and research that supports the vendor narrative. So if I'm a customer, I'm surrounded by kind of an echo chamber of over optimism and a downplaying of risks. And that starts during the decision procurement and purchasing process, but it continues into implementation too. So when I get into implementation, I start hitting some pretty significant road bumps or obstacles. A lot of times what you see is you've got the vendor and the system integrator who are in CYA mode. So they don't want to look bad. So they end up saying, hey, you know, everything's fine. This is normal. You know, it's just a hiccup. It's, you know, these projects are never perfect. And, you know, project status is still green. Don't worry. Everything's green, green, green. And so it's not as nefarious as it might sound on the surface. It's more, it's an understandable human dynamic, but it's a human behavior that, and a psychology that really drives a lot of problems. And I don't know there's an easy answer to fix it other than being aware of it. And so I think that's the biggest thing is that all the parties surrounding you, if you're a customer, are telling you things that aren't necessarily reality. Part of it too is that the vendors and consultants oftentimes are just looking at technology. The technology works, so they don't see it from the customer perspective a lot of the times. Like, you know, if I'm a customer, I might say, the software works. I get it. Like, it's not erroring out. There's no bugs. The data is clean or whatever, but it just doesn't fit my business. Like, I need it to do something totally different because I have a different business model than what your software supports. But, you know, a lot of times then you get into gaslighting where the vendors will say, well, but you're resistant to change. If you would just accept our best practices and the software the way it was built, everything would be fine. And it would be fine from a technical perspective, but it's going to create catastrophic results on the business side. And that's the disconnect. It's really that disconnect between expectations and reality, as well as technology vendor view versus customer business view. Those things are always in conflict, and you just have to know how to see through that.
Well, you also mentioned in that you're coming out, you're writing a book about this. What? Tell me about the book. Tell me about when's it coming out. Give me you've written four. Why did we need, or you've written three. Why did we need fourth?
Well, it's so I actually have three or two full length. This will be my third full length book. And the first one I wrote was called The Final Countdown. And that was more focused on digital strategy, how to define a roadmap. Great book. I like it. But then I thought, you know what? that's good. That's sort of like your playbook of what you should do. But I wanted to get then follow it up with, well, why don't, what happens when you don't do that? And what do companies typically do instead of that? And so that was Welcome to the Jungle. That was more focused on failure case studies. So these are projects that failed. Here's why. Here's what they did wrong. Here's what you should do different. And then this book, I thought, you know, I started, I've just been thinking about human behavior and psychology a lot lately, which is why I appreciate your question so much, because I started realizing, again, you know, if you depersonalize it, this isn't like an evil, even though the name Welcome to the Machine has a draconian, dystopian, Pink Floyd, you know, Orwellian sort of vibe to it. It's really not that. I mean, it wasn't like some master plan by the tech industry to be evil and to screw people and to, you know, cause all these failures. That was not it. But the way the ecosystems were built were meant to favor technology companies, which is understandable. Yeah. That's why they were built. But the customers just aren't sophisticated and mature enough in many cases to deal with the machine. So I really wanted a way to say, hey, here's the inside, the inner workings of the machine. Don't avoid it. Just know it's there and know how to navigate it and avoid it from consuming you or prevent it from consuming you. And so that was really the reason I wanted to follow up Welcome to the Jungle. Is failures happen, here's why. But let's go even deeper now and look at, if we're going even deeper, here's really why they fail and here's, you know, the things you need to overcome. Whereas Welcome to the Jungle might have been a little bit more focused on symptoms. This is getting into the root cause of why those symptoms happen in the first place. And so I'm hoping that between the three, you get like a pretty good deep understanding of how these projects can and should work.
Oh, well, when it comes out, I need an autographed copy.
I'll actually get you one. It's later this month. It's in April of 2026. It'll be out available on Amazon worldwide. So I don't have the exact date in front of me, but it is late April 2026.
Well, I'll send you some autographed copies of mine
too. Yes, please do. I would love to.
If the last question, this is, I can't believe we've gone an hour. I mean, we've been just,
time flies.
Going. I could go. I mean, this is a blast for me, but we've got to bring it to all good things must come to a close. So
yes, unfortunately,
if a CEO is sitting right here, right now, and they're ready to invest about $5, $10, $50 million in a new technology, what is the one thing you would want them to understand before they write the check?
Good question. I'd say more than anything, know what you're getting yourself into long term, because right now is a pretty interesting inflection point in the industry, because it's always been a challenge, right? All these decisions have always had long term implications as far as how you're going to run your business, what your cost structure looks like. But now it's even more pronounced, because now you're dealing mostly with cloud technologies where the vendor has control. They, for better or for worse, they own your applications. The data is in their cloud or in their infrastructure. If they want to change the way the software works, you don't have nearly as much flexibility as you used to have when you had an on-premise system that you could customize and do whatever you wanted with it. So that's one thing. You just have to recognize you're moving your risk now in a different way. Your cost structure is changing now to where you've got what used to be a one-time capital investment that you depreciated. Now you're increasing your operating expenses long-term. Yep. And by the way, those are only going to increase over time. They're not coming back down. So what you buy today is as cheap as it's ever going to be. It's going to continue to go up. And now you add AI to the mix. That's where it gets really interesting and scary at the same time, is if I'm a vendor and I'm saying, hey, Jim, I've got 1,000 AI agents that you could be using that we built. And you say, great, I'm going to do it. I'm going to do a little pilot. I'm going to trial. And now all of a sudden I've got 1,000 AI agents in my organization. And then 2 years from now, I say, Jim, you know how I introduced those AI agents to you? Well, that's kind of a loss leader pilot sort of thing. Now we're actually going to charge you for those 1,000 AI agents. Yeah. That's where I worry, is I don't know that buyers fully understand that the power and the control and the leverage is shifting dramatically to the vendors now, because now they own they don't own the data, but they house the data. They're training their AI models with the data. The applications are there. They can change the applications whenever, however they want. The IP that you used to have in your customization on-prem, now you've gotten rid of a lot of that IP. Now you're just going clean core. You're moving everything to a vanilla software. So you just be aware. Like, it might be the right thing for you. I'm not saying don't do it, but I'm a little alarmed at how little people think about those things. And what does that mean for us long term and our flexibility, our cost structure, our competitive advantages, all that stuff. So I would just back up, think about your business and what's best for you before you invest that $5 or $10 million or whatever it is.
Oh, that's great insight. Great insight. I think this has been just a great time with you. I feel like I've gotten to know you better. I can't, you know, we'll have to do this again in, you know, 6 months, or you can have me on your podcast and we can.
Yeah, I have an outstanding open invite for you to be on mine. So I need to get you on mine ASAP.
Absolutely. We'll love that. And then the other thing we ought to do is think about working together on a project, because I'm always finding people who need you, and I'm sure you're finding people that need me, and we probably work together on a couple projects. But
absolutely.
That's it for today. I want to thank everyone for tuning in. Please subscribe. Please go buy Eric's books, buy my books, become subscribers of both of our channels. And so that's it for now. We'll talk to you next time.
Thanks, Jim.